you see are part of your Australian culture that that you have to preach to or wrestle with or affect the kind of preaching that you do? Sure, you have put it together, and maybe some of your secretaries could respond.
There was one interesting one that was actually given to us by Kevin, who actually is a Californian, who's now in Australia, who was California, now in Australia. From an outsider point of view, looking on, which sort of rang a bell with the rest of us in the group, and that is that Australians are hedonists rather than materialists.
I think that strikes me as having validity to it. That is, they're not that interested in making money as they are in making whoopee. I can see that. Yeah. What would you agree with that? I mean, do you hear that? Do you think that's right? How does that show up in a practical way? That is, that they take their weekends to go to the beach or the mountains? I mean, this sort of thing, or other things. Yeah, that's interesting. Materialism may be just a means to another end. What else? That's good. Yeah.
Well, I think Manny Clark aptly described it as the land of the long weekend. And that's where it ties into that Hellenistic attitude of we live for the weekends. We live for the long weekends. We live for holidays.
It's interesting that in that connection, if that's an accurate observation, I suspect it is, you're much more like people in Latin America than you would be people in Northern Europe or even in a good part of the United States. And that is, people in Latin America live for a fiesta. And they make their money, but their whole purpose in life is fiesta. Whereas in North America, that has come out of Northern European background, there is a tendency to still carry the Puritan work ethic, not because they're Puritans, but a vacation is something you take off from work. Whereas in Latin America, you work in order to have the fiesta. And people working in Latin America that don't understand that often feel one kind of thing they would get is that people there are lazy. But it isn't, well, maybe that they're lazy, but they're not any lazier than anybody else. It's just that they put a value on, having a good time. And they tend to be short-ranged. That is, they live for the next fiesta. They try to get them to save in that part of the world for, 10 years. And that's one of the most difficult things they have to do. The idea is you make money, you spend it. Whereas in our culture, at least it's influenced by Northern European, you make money and you save it. If you ask, what are you saving it for? Well, you save it for a rainy day, whatever that means. It's not that it's any more virtuous, it's just that it comes out of that background. In that sense, you seem to be that way.
Interesting observation on that topic is that the government is moving us in that direction as well. It's part of our culture, because if you think of Expo 88, the theme was leisure in the age of technology. And if you think of the issue of poker machines coming in to Queensland, the government is helping people to decide how they're going to spend their day.
With the poker machines?
What sort of activities they'll be involved in day to day. So the government is tending to move people in that direction within our culture too.
I suppose it's a kind of a cycle, isn't it? People who push for leisure, the government gives them what they want in order to stay in, and then by doing that they add to the, round and round you go, so that government is both prescriptive and responsive to what goes on. What other things that you find? Yes?
An attitude of have a go. Let's have a go at something.
Anything.
Innovative.
I mean, just the sense of risk, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Huh. Spell that out for me a bit more. I mean, how would that show up?
Small businesses having a go. Some of them succeeding, turning into large ones.
I see.
Other ones
collapse. Just willing to take a risk.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't think I had. Would you all agree with that? I mean, are we talking about the. You say once upon a time. It's less so today.
The spirit of the Australian digger, this is the First and Second World War, and the end of that mateship, and an ethic. It was honourable, very, very honourable, in fact, recognised by the rest of the world. But that is no longer the case because of communications like television, and that has spoiled what we used to call the Australian spirit. The Aussie spirit is disintegrated into oblivion now, and we are kind of a shore that gets anything washed up onto us. Because we're an island nation, we kind of retain it, and it's very hard to put your finger on anything solid to formulate a psychology of behaviour.
I mean, progressive behaviour to get things done?
I can't find much at all these days to grab hold of as a preacher. The only thing that I know for sure is there's nothing for sure. It's just get out there, and what used to be the Australia of old is no longer. It's now, because they've brought different nationalities into the country, because we have our Prime Minister refused to put his hand on the Bible, and his cabinet ministers were equally as bad. So we're headed up by a totally ungodly and militantly anti-God leadership in this country right this very second.
That's interesting.
And they've brought in the humanistic, they call this country a multicultural, they're trying to, society, when in actual fact it's a multinational society with people from all over the world. And they've perverted the nature of the word culture, which delves into ethics and religion and beliefs that people died for, the spirit of the old Australia, all of that stuff. They're trying to kill it by calling our country, just because there's people coming from all over the world here, they're calling it multicultural, to destroy the Australian culture, and they've succeeded. In other words, a multicultural society is a society without any culture, and they've managed to mix up the original Australian culture and spirit that was honourable in many ways, not a Christian way, but...
So there is no common denominator.
No, it's just disintegrating.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, I have to disagree. I'm not necessarily that one, but I may disagree with that as well, but I'm a walk, so I have to... On the other thing, I think we generally are so egalitarian, we don't want people to achieve, we're jealous of that. We'd rather pull people down to our level, that is, we tend to be fairly conservative, and churches often demonstrate that. We won't have a go because it's already been tried, it's already failed. So I think we're not imaginative, we're not very...
Do you think that may be more true of churches than the society generally, or is the church reflecting the society?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I can't answer that because you've got to be fairly been all around Australia and have a fairly good knowledge of it. I can't say, but in terms of people that I guess in my circle, I've moved people, and that's not church. People are envious of people who succeeded. We don't like people who stood up and achieved things necessarily. Just want to pull them down so that they're not that much far away.
It's interesting, as I've been here, I'm no expert in your culture, but I think I've heard that theme more than any other, that it's very hard for somebody to lead, to stand out, without all of the dwarfs coming in league against them. So it becomes a problem of... in political life, religious life, any kind of life, at least that is, I've had more people report that. One thing that does happen in a culture that where you're under siege as a church is that churches that are under siege often become very conservative. They often have a whole lot of rules and so forth. It's a way of identifying the people in the in-group. And in a sense, putting up a wall against the outgroup. It's a way of, I guess, keeping from being overwhelmed by the culture. It's not a particularly good way to handle it, but it could well be that in a culture that had lost its moorings, the people in the church would say, you know, for God's sake and all that's holy, we're going to hold on to singing the same 27 hymns and Yeah, that kind of thing. Yes?
This tall poppy syndrome business that people are talking about has become a fad over the last few months because leading politicians are using that as a reason for why people are attacking them and what they're doing.
Oh, because so they are leaders and they're...
This is why you're hearing it so much now, because they're trying to use it over the media to sort of justify this is why we're being attacked.
I'm a leader, you can tell people are against me.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly why that's so common.
Smart politicians, yeah.
Part of the tall poppy syndrome is related to the fact that Australians have trouble dealing with authority figures in general and being directed. Sometimes we give respect to those people, but sometimes we feel threatened by authority.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think there is a... You think it comes out of your background as a penal colony?
Part of the authority, and they still, that lack of respect and distrust they have for authority, you know, is bound up with the church as well.
Church, so what he was saying was that the church has been in the past part of the ruling class, and therefore people against the church because it was part of the ruling class, and if you're against authority, you'd be against the church.
I think that part of the problem at present is that the credibility of all leadership in Australia has come very much into question.
Political, religious, I mean all...
Yep. In our own state of Queensland here, there was a purge through the police force, and it was found that probably most of the senior police officers in Queensland were corrupt, involved in bribery charges and such things as that. We now have three politicians in jail on corruption and misappropriation charges, and others awaiting trial. In our election system, we're vastly different from America. In America, you have your grand parades and all the, you know, yahooing and going on that is quite an entertaining feature. In Australia, politicians running against each other make no promises anymore. They don't bother because they never keep them. They just dig up the mud about the opposition and slander each other non-stop for 2 months before the election. And so leadership has no credibility. And then bringing that into the life of the churches, we've got failures in the church. You know, people like Jimmy Baker and those sorts of characters are big news in Australia, and there have been a number of them. Here in Brisbane, in our own country, we've got the same thing going on in popular figures and even in the lesser-known church leaders. And so I think the credibility of leadership in general, and particularly in the church, has fallen to probably an all-time low. And this makes it very difficult to be a leader in that sort of environment.
That's very interesting. We have experienced something of that in the United States. In 1981, Newsweek, which is one of our major news magazines, talked about 1981 as the year of the evangelical. In 1991, there isn't anybody that would say that this is the year of the evangelical. In that decade, in our case, I think we blew our opportunities. We had all kinds of opportunities. And part of it was that when... some of it was moral, and we got that. But the other part was that when we had a chance to be involved in the public life, we didn't know what we were doing. And therefore... we came through as being very naive and unsophisticated and simplistic, and to a degree we were. having had what I think was a marvelous opportunity, we just they threw us the ball and we just dropped it, and you pay a price for that. You pay a price for it. Yeah.
I'd just like to ask a question on the comment you made earlier. You said that at the apparent reaction often of the church to the fear of being overwhelmed by society is to become more conservative, which is not a particularly good way of handling it. What is a better way of handling it?
To become more committed. That is, conservatism is often a way of keeping the forms that we were used to and that we like and we're comfortable with. If people are more committed to Jesus Christ, in the sense of saying we are in this society as a salt, or we are in it as a light. We may only be a candle, but when it gets real dark, candles are a great help. But we are committed in such a way that, as a matter of integrity, as a matter of the way we do our business, in a culture like that, Christians can stand out. You get an honest television repair man in a culture where you get ripped off every time you turn around, that person stands out in a way that is a great testimony. But what you put in the place of commitment is conservatism. Commitment has in it an inner dynamic. Conservatism keeps the shell, even though the internal side may be kind of sometimes corrupt, sometimes lackadaisical. Committed people, back in the, when Lenin went to Russia in 1917, he had 20,000 followers. And in the 50 years that followed, communism came to dominate a third of the world's population, about three-fifths of the world's land surface. And what communism gave to people, for better or worse, was something to live for and something to die for. I think it was General Omar Bradley, late General Omar Bradley, said the most committed person I've ever met was a convinced communist. What you did not have with communism until recently was conservatism. What you got in Russia, which ultimately destroyed it, was people wanted to keep the forms, but they had lost the commitment. When communists were committed, they took over the world. When they became conservative, that is, to hold the form and keep the structures and get the bureaucracy, that was the beginning of the end. So how to get that, to get people committed is something else, but I think that's the difference, yeah.
You may have the same issue with the States, but that conservative issue is one of the big things that I see has ruined our churches. We live in such a rapidly changing era that the majority of people in the churches don't want, when they go to church on Sunday, to have the same turmoil that they have to face from Monday to Saturday. The supermarket's changing, they're changing the currency, the world situation. So they come to church and they expect to find some security. And I believe what we've done is that we've actually seen churches as a haven where we stare at our own belly buttons rather than the place where we get equipped to go and fight. And there's just so much fighting around that basically the average churchgoer doesn't want to fight anymore.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that those churches that really promote this cause to fight, the advancing of Christ's cause, they're the ones who seem to be growing anyway, taking the fact that we are to be salt and light in our society.
I think that's a good insight. And I think it's important. It's important to recognize that one reason people go to church is to find a still point in their turning world. If where you work, everything is up for grabs. If in the media, everything is changing, then you go to church. Part of what you want is something that will stay secure and firm even when the world is changing. I think that one lesson to learn from that is if you make changes, you need to plot your changes. If you change form, for instance, if you change the form of your sermons, the way you preach, then that's not the Sunday to change all the music and change the time of the service. If you're going to change your music, you need, in the most churches, to do it and plan to do it and to do it gradually. Because whenever you change form, people get upset with that. And it's a psychological upset. And even the churches in the United States that are aggressive and reaching out into the community are very careful about changes, about how they bring them in. The changes have purpose. They see to it that they win approval before they make the change. Because of that psychological fact, sometimes you get the churches where Nothing will change them. And what happens in those churches is that the churches will do well when the older people, and they're usually the ones who want, older doesn't necessarily mean years, but that kind of a group, they'll do well, but they'll lose their children. Because you're able to keep the club going the way it's going, and you get the money to support it. But those churches often lose their young people. But too many changes too fast psychologically are very difficult for people to handle. For years, the Roman Catholics went to school on that. But the thing about going to a Catholic church is that they had services in Latin, and they did, you go into their cathedrals and all sorts of things there reminded you that this church had been in business for a long time. I think one of the things that happened to the Catholic Church, they made changes to try to get into the 20th century, and they were hurt by it. Because one thing they had to give to people was the sense of the eternal, the way their worship was structured. Even though you couldn't understand the service, it was in Latin, and you knew Jesus spoke Latin, and everybody that was worth anything spoke Latin. But when they made those changes, Pope John changed the church radically, actually, and I think from there on out, the Catholic Church has really suffered, simply because of this phenomena we're talking about.
Some of the characteristics of Australian makeup that we spoke about, I'd be interested in hearing other people's comments. We mentioned that probably Australians are fairly unemotional people.
Unemotional?
Unemotional, not very demonstrative. And we spoke about that in connection with the acceptability of appeals. It's difficult to get people to maybe demonstrate something that may be going on inside. They're, in connection with that, they're pretty private people, likely to keep their opinions to themselves, not see, especially see religion as something that has to be worn on your shirt sleeve. And Don mentioned before about us being hedonists. Well, we spoke about being people who just live for today, pretty much, not planning too much for the future and not making commitments for the future. And even the, I think related to the tall poppy syndrome a bit, is the cynic. We'll all be ruined.
Everything's going to go bad anyhow, huh?
Yeah,
which would play into the hedonism. If eat, drink, and eat, drink, be merry, because tomorrow is going to be a disaster. That unemotional and private, that's interesting. How many of you would agree with that? Do you think that's true? I mean, I've watched Australians at the Australian rules football. I didn't find them unemotional. I mean, I thought. that's what it is.
Spoke about the way that perhaps the footy and the cricket are the two places where you're allowed to be emotional.
And that's why it comes.
And you can put it away after an hour and a half and go back and just be yourself.
Yeah, I see. So the sports would be a way
to vent it. Get emotional.
Yeah. Huh.
Not about religion, not about many things, but you are allowed to show a bit at sport.
Huh.
The one place where people is confined. You only strike people getting outside of sporting.
But when you're playing international matches, then it's all right to be patriotic.
Yeah, but otherwise, you don't see it very much. Not in the
RSL clubs. Isn't that interesting? I know sports is a...
I really feel that perhaps we might be getting a little negative here about the society in which we live. And many, many things which we've been saying here this afternoon has been true. But still out there, there's a lot of people with a lot of need and a lot of hope. I don't believe the church has got it quite right. And I'm so grateful that so many people here, so many pastors, so many people within the church are so keen and are praying and working
and yet we still do not appear to have it quite right, because there's a tremendous amount of need in the communities where we are. And whether it's our institutionalism or not, I know not, but there are people there, the opportunities are there, the church is ready to go, it's praying, and yet we just can't seem to bridge those two worlds in which we live.
I think whenever you're going to penetrate a culture, the kinds of questions you have to ask are, what are the needs, what are the felt needs of a culture, and what is it that the church can do to meet those needs? And sometimes, in order to, and in the churches that have been, I think, successful in reaching non-Christians in the United States, ask that question incessantly. And often what they will do is to meet a need that is external, that isn't directly religious, in order to attract people so that in turn they will be able to speak to them about the needs they didn't recognize. There will be churches that would have a Mother's Day out, or work with children, or not as an evangelistic tool, but simply as a way of saying, this is a need in our community, we're going to meet that need, in the hope that having attracted people with what is external and felt will bring people within the sphere of a church that can then witness to them about needs they didn't even realize they had. But to diagnose the needs of the culture. And by the way, I don't know the magazine that you would have that would correspond to it, but in the United States we have a magazine called Advertising Age. And I take a look at it every so often. Advertisers do that continually. I mean, when they want to move the merchandise, they're asking questions about, how do these people think? How do they feel? What do they value? And they work at it. I mean, they do the studies, they do everything. And they have a handle on a culture, because they know that's where you make the bucks. And sometimes the church doesn't. It's hard for us to think about the culture and its felt needs. And if you can answer that question, where is the need felt, then where is there some point of contact?
Just one comment. We're talking about materialism, and perhaps this comes under materialism, but white Australians have got a certain feature in their thinking where they won't believe in an unseen world. They have to be able to touch it, and I see that as being a problem. I say white Australians because I've had a fair bit of contact with Aboriginal people through my work, and the Aboriginal culture has no trouble at all accepting that there's an unseen world. It's just a matter of what it's like.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you're talking, Dr. Robinson, about how to attract people. Not that we do things for anybody just so that we can attract them. We do it because we should do it. But I was at the shopping town the other day, and there was a little stall in the middle of the walkway and had some balloons, blown up balloons, hanging from it. And my four-year-old said, "Daddy, I'd like one of those balloons, please." And I said, "Oh, well, we'll see." So as we got closer, the lady had a lot of balloons on top of the counter which she hadn't blown up. And I thought, "Oh, well, we'll just see." So when we got there, the first thing she did was, "Would the little girl like a balloon?" And she gave her one of the blown up ones. And then she said, "Look," she said, "just while you're here, if you'd like to give me your name and address, we've just got this plan on how to provide for your children's future education, and we could just send you some information." And I thought, that is just superb. The balloons were taking the children to the stand. It was
right.
It was like flies to a honeypot, you know. Superb example of perhaps what you're talking about.
Our church at Denver, where we just started when we were growing, but one summer we called it Fun Day School. And when anybody drove in, we had clowns meeting them, you know, out at the parking lot, and we had puppets and the whole thing. And it was amazing, the response we got. For some people, this is kind of, you know, what does God have to do with clowns? But kids have a lot to do with clowns, you know. And Yeah, and that's, you know, it's simply the same thing to say, if you're going to reach them, they were bringing you, I mean, they didn't, you wouldn't go for the balloons, but your kids would, and they were interested in reaching you because of your kids. And yeah, people do that.
I think that in that context, there's a reluctance in church thinking to accept this type of promotion of Christianity. It's undignified, it's unchristian, it's un-something or other.
Yeah.
Just as an example, I went into one of our Christian bookstores recently to find a book on motivation. I feel a need to motivate the people in our church. And there wasn't a single book on that subject in our fairly large Christian bookstore. There were two books that had a chapter each on it, and that was the entire content of our bookshop on this secular thing of motivating people.
Yeah.
And I went around the corner to a general bookstore and they had 20 feet of shelving with books on motivation.
Yeah, it's an interesting insight.
I think somewhere along the line the church is hanging back too far. We've got to get into that world of motivating people, of using business techniques in the promotion of the gospel.
Now, when Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 9, you know, he wants to be all things to all men so that by all means he might win some. In that chapter, his idea is basically he'll do anything short of sinning to win men and women of Jesus Christ. And I have a friend of mine who's a pastor who says that in his church, people think that change is sin, and they'll commit every other sin but that. yes.
It's one of the things that I come across in talking to people is that the churches, the way they were, and because of the lack of change, people always seem to say that, but the Catholic Church did this to me and sort of like pinned me to the chair and beat me with the Bible over the head. And that's so, it's not just the Catholic Church, it's some of the older mainline churches. And the changing that's being brought in now is, with a bit of life in that, is fantastic, and that's going to start to change, but it's just going to take a little bit of time though. This is, I'm talking about only the sector I've been, as with Sydney and here. What's happening is, because of the old style, people have rejected that.
Yeah.
The old style, rather than when they knew a change, it's going to take a little bit more to get into that, just a little bit more time, more music, live music. That'll happen. It will, because that's what Australians are looking for also.
Now, what always strikes you, if people are very slow to change, by the time they make the change, the world has gone on. I think the kind of thing you're discussing here is the every year, every 2 years, I prepare for our board about a 7-8 page sheet on education and social things, entertainment and so forth, of the things that are going on in the culture. When we make our plans, you have to ask, what are your presuppositions as you make plans? Because if you make plans based on presuppositions, and don't ask the questions about presuppositions, the presuppositions can turn out to be wrong. And as a result, you've made the plans, but your presuppositions change, and you keep on with your plans. So as we do our 5-year plan each year for the seminary, we ask, you know, what is going on in the broad culture? What's going on in the more narrow culture? What do we see this, if this is true today, what do we see this doing in the future? You're not always right, but you're a lot better off if you said we're making these plans based on this presupposition about the future. And we're more often right than wrong. It's not prophecy. It's simply saying, this is true today. We would expect this to be true in the future. You can't always plan on Iraq showing up when you think the world has come to peace. But once Iraq shows up, you can ask yourself, what would you project in the future if we go to war? Into such things as, what's the cost of oil going to be? What's the cost, what's going to happen to investments, and what's going to happen to a country like ours, and how will that show up in people's lives? But it's that kind of thing that you need to be doing as you look to the future, because whatever plans you make have to be made on the basis of some presupposition. And what is that presupposition? You know, what is it you're saying is happening in the culture, will happen in the culture, and what plans are you going to make in your church or in your groups in order to hit that?
We found at Palm Beach at one stage there was the older group, regular churchgoers of the morning, and a rather large youth group. And the youth didn't like the way the service was done down the line. The older group didn't like it the other way. So what they decided was that once or twice a month that they'd have a youth service of the night, but the mainstream would be most of the time. They found after a while that the older people were going to the youth service and the young people were going to the older ones. And gradually, it's like burning the candle from both ends. They got together.
That's great.
Your comments we just had reflect something our group discussed. We see that there is in Australia, a gradually increasing tendency for there to be distinct subcultural groups. Like you have the old people in your church and the young people in your church. You have the academics and the non-academics. And between these groups, there tends, because of our television-oriented society, these groups don't have very much interaction, and it's getting less and less all the time. And we saw that as something that the church has to address.
Yeah. If that type of thing continues, our culture is greatly hurt by that. Where young people have no contact with older people, or vice versa, you know, a church is hurt by it. That's just a comment. That is not a cure. Let me move on to something else before we close today, if you will, because I think what we have I find it interesting to hear these. It's interesting the commonalities you feel, even though you come from different areas. The second question that we had was simply a way of saying, how do you change to adapt to audiences? It seems to me there are several different places. You do it in your introduction. That is, where do you touch people? Where do you get the hook to them? You do it with your illustrations. Illustrations for a yuppie group will be quite different than people who are rural. I think you do it sometimes with the style with which you preach. The more traditional church, there will be a more traditional kind of sermon. The less traditional church, the less traditional the sermon. I think it can even affect things like whether or not you use a pulpit. For some churches, the pulpit is a way of showing stability. I think for other churches, the lack of a pulpit is a way of showing what is contemporary, because it reflects what goes on television. But let me back off and talk a bit about the idea. It was George Bernard Shaw who said that 5% of the people think, 15% of the people think they think, and the other 80% would rather die than think. H.G. Wells said something of the same sort when he said that most people do not think more than once or twice in a lifetime. And he said he had made an international reputation thinking once or twice a year. Now, all of that can be bad news when you discover that as a preacher, one of the things you're called on to do a couple of times a week is to think. And thinking is hard work. But that happens to be the case, that you and I, whatever else we're involved in, are in a battle for the minds of men and women. That in the broad culture, at least in the Western world, we have been in a battle, whether we knew it or not, with Marxism. And only recently, after 75 years, has Marxism suffered a real hammer blow, and we wonder if it's going to be able to continue. But if you were in Europe and you did any kind of evangelism, you talked to people who are Marxists. And that was a battle of ideas, of philosophy. Islam is a religion, but it's also a philosophy of life. It is probably becoming the dominant philosophy against which we will have to compete in the world of ideas. materialism and hedonism are also philosophies of life, often not spelled out as neatly as Marxism or Christianity or Islam, but every bit is real and every bit is claiming of men and women's allegiance. So we are in a battle for people's minds. We are in a conflict of ideas. When you come to ask, that leads you to ask a very important question, and that is, what is an idea? If you were to bump into one in a dark alley, would you recognize it? You tell me, what is an idea? What do you mean when you talk about an idea? What?
Thought of direction.
A thought of direction, okay, a thought and an idea. What else?
Crystallizing of a concept.
All right, a crystallizing of a concept, a thought, a concept. What I find interesting about that question, it's sort of irritating. I mean, you sort of think, well, look, let's get on. Everybody knows what an idea is. But usually when we try to define an idea, it's like a cheap dictionary. You know, idea, see thought, go to thought, says see concept, go to concept, it says see idea. I mean, you know, round you go. But all of those have meaning. A concept comes from the word conceive, which you bring the sperm and the egg together and you produce a child. Or an insight, you has the idea of seeing into something, not just external. The word idea comes from the Greek word eido, which means to know or to see. Same Greek word means to know or to see, and you can understand that. You get an idea or thought and you say, oh, I see what you mean. So you comprehend. If I were going to define an idea, I would call it, I would say it's a distillation of meaning, which is a kind of an abstract thing to say. But what I mean by that is this. Life is made up of a lot of particulars. And so you have a particular here, a particular there, a particular here, a particular here, all sorts of particulars. And what an idea does is to distill from these particulars certain things that they have in common. It distills out of them what they have in common. We have a close friend, and years ago when our children were small and their children were small, we went over to their home for our Thanksgiving holiday. And we had a brunch before we were going to have our main dinner. And my friend Bruce asked his son, Jonathan, to thank God for the food. Jonathan was probably 3 at the time, and so he said, Dear God, thank you for the eggs, thank you for the toast, thank you for the jam, thank you for the orange juice, thank you for the milk. And then he looked over to his sister Susan. He said, thank you for Susan's toast, thank you for Susan's eggs, thank you for Susan's milk, thank you, you know, for Susan's orange juice. And he started in with his father, and finally his dad said, all right, Jonathan, say amen. At first, I thought, you give this kid the limelight, and he's going to stay on stage all morning, and everything will get cold. But I realized that at that age, Jonathan had not learned the concept of breakfast. So when his father said, thank God for the food, he thanked him for all of the particulars on everybody's plate. There'll come a time when he will be able to abstract from the eggs and the toast and the orange juice the concept of breakfast. And that's part of what you do when you get educated. That's part of what you do when you learn. So an idea, in that sense, is a distillation of life. It is a way of putting the particulars of life together so that you live beyond the particulars to what they have in common. Now, we live and move and die on the basis of ideas. Most of the ideas that move us and shape us are ideas that are subliminal, that is, below the level of conscious thought. And advertisers know that. Advertisers know that if they're going to move the merchandise, that what they have to do is to implant in the basement of your mind a ghost of an idea that you haven't been able to take out and look at, but it's that idea planted in your mind that causes you to buy. For example, years ago, Marlboro cigarettes, when it first came out, was a cigarette for women. It was like the Virginia Dare cigarette that's now in the United States. But it didn't sell. So they did some surveys to find out why men smoked. They found that men smoked because they thought it made them masculine. And then they found that women smoked because they thought it made them more attractive to men. So Marlboro changed its whole approach, and you got Marlboro Man. He's riding a horse, usually out in the outback someplace. And there's nothing in that ad. Macho character riding a horse and bringing in stray lambs or something. And down below it says Marlboro cigarettes. And in our country, on the other side, it says the Surgeon General says this will kill you. But what the message is that if you smoke Marlboros, you'll be a man. Now, you and I know that Marlboro country is a cemetery, that the Marlboro man is dying of cancer. But the reality is that while cigarettes can harm you, the ad is saying it will make you masculine. And Marlboro cigarettes has been, at least in our country, one of the top four selling brands for years and years because of that ad. You, in this country, more than even in ours, you sell your beer with the macho image. Drink a keg of beer, drink a bottle of beer, you're a man. Drink a keg of beer, you're a Superman. You're dead drunk, you can't get up, you know, but that's not the message. Now, if the beer sponsors or Marlboro printed that, if they said, if you drink beer, you're a man, you'd look at that rationally and say, that's stupid. Dumbest thing I've ever read. If you smoke a pack of Marlboros a day, you really understand what masculinity is. You would reject it out of hand. But the people who move the merchandise know that if they can plant the idea without you examining it, they have scored. So you get men's products, men's cologne. And the idea is if you use this cologne, you're going to have to beat the women off. In fact, if you look at the ads closely, you as a Christian couldn't use this stuff. At least if you use it, you would do it in secret. It'd have scandal written all over it. I use it. It's never happened to me, so I can assure you it's safe. Or you take a woman's perfume. Look at the ads. My sin, taboo, obsession. I mean, I've never seen a perfume called Puritan Hang-Up. you can't, it won't move the merchandise. I mean, what they do is that they sell you image. Cars have names, Cougar and Rabbit and Mustang and, you don't get Turtles. Because they know that people buy cars because of some dream or image that they've got, and they play to the image. So when it comes to ideas, most of the ideas by which people live, by which people die, are planted in their minds without their consciously being able to evaluate them. Most of the things you were talking about here today are not spelled out, but people have adopted them and embraced them. On television, you have a constant bombardment of secularity. I mean, on television you get people who are robbed and raped and murdered and whose homes break up and who are engaged in all kinds of violence. And yet from one end of the week to another, you never see those folks stop and pray, never see them go to church, never see them seek out a pastor. In the world of television, that is a secular world in which all kinds of terrible things happen to people, and there isn't a bit of spirituality. The comedians on television, I don't think they get together and say, you know, what can we do to damn Australia? I think they just tell their jokes. The best way to defeat virtue is to laugh at it. If you debate virtue, if you really debate it, virtue will win over the course of history. Integrity and justice and faithfulness have won because they are the virtues that have held the culture together. You can argue those things and win. But if you laugh at virtue, then without ever having a chance to go to court, the virtue loses and the vice is established. In our culture, we are bombarded with that. But if you and I are going to deal in the world of ideas, we have got to understand what an idea is. We've got to be able to look at it. In order to be able to evaluate an idea, and in order to be able to communicate it, we have to be able to identify it. And that's in the face of a culture that's doing everything it can to keep you from identifying the ideas that move you, that cause you to buy what you buy and live as you live and love as you love and die as you die. But we've got to be able to identify them. So when you look at the way to identify an idea, idea has two parts to it. First of all, an idea has a subject. And when we talk about the subject, or when I talk about the subject, and we talk about it together, the subject is the answer to the question, what is this man or woman talking about? It is the complete, well-defined answer to that question. What is this person talking about? A subject, an idea has a subject, but an idea also has a complement. And the word complement comes out of our word complete. So the complement completes the subject. And it's the answer to the question, what is this person saying about what he's talking about? As simple as it may seem, the anatomy of an idea consists of the answer to those two questions. What is the person talking about? It's the full, well-defined answer to that question. What's that person saying about what he is talking about? Now, when we talk about a subject, we are not talking about a grammatical subject. A grammatical subject can be a single word. It often is. This subject can never be a single word. Let me say that again because it's very important. When we talk about a subject, we're not talking about a single word. It can never be a single word. It's the complete, well-defined answer to the question, what's this person talking about? And the complement completes that. For example, if I say to you, the test of a person's character. What did you preach on last Sunday? I preached on the test of a person's character. What is that? All right, it's a subject. Give me a complement to that subject. The test of a person's character.
Is shown by what he does under pressure.
What he does under pressure, okay? Test of a person's character is what he does when he's under pressure. Well, give me another compliment.
What he does when he's in private.
What he does what?
He's in private.
When he's in private. What you would do if you were absolutely certain nobody would ever find out. Test of a man, like the test of an oak, is how strong is he at the roots. You change the compliment and you change the idea. You have a subject, test of a person's character. And the compliment completes that. Or take another one. What this country needs. That's a subject. What did you talk about last week? Talk about what this country needs. You don't have an idea. You have a subject. Give me a compliment to that subject. An honest politician. Okay? Good leadership. Okay. All right, you change the compliment, you've changed the idea. In this case, they may be the same. You can get an honest politician, you might find a good leader. Okay. What this country needs is a good 5-cent cigar. Yeah. This country needs a good 5-cent cigar. It only costs a dollar. Change the compliment and you change the idea. But an idea is the answer to the question, what is this person talking about? That's your subject. The compliment is, what is the person saying about what he's talking about? In Acts chapter 2, Paul preaches the sermon at the day of Pentecost. Peter preaches the sermon on the day of Pentecost. The idea of that sermon is that God has made him Lord in Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. It's developed inductively. That's the idea. Right? In that idea, God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you've crucified. In that statement, what would be the grammatical subject? God. First word, God. That's the subject. But what is the subject in terms of what Peter is talking about? God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. What is he talking about? What's the subject? All right, it's Jesus, but it's not just Jesus. It's not about his virgin birth. It's not about his pre-incarnate state. What is it? All right, it's really what God has made Jesus whom you've crucified. And the compliment is he has made him Lord in Christ. The point, again, is the subject is never a single word. You can't preach a sermon on God. I mean, get hold of that would be really interesting to see somebody try. You always have to narrow it. And one of the ways of narrowing it is with the interrogative questions. You know, what's that the bit of doggerel I had? Six faithful men who taught me all I knew. Who and why and where and when and how and something and who. Because I got seven. But those interrogatives help you to limit your subject. So you have a subject and a compliment. All right, all of that may or may not make any sense to you. So let me do something for the next few minutes. Let me take a few passages and let's look at them together and decide what the subjects and compliments are. Okay? Let's take a passage like James chapter 1. And for the sake of what I want to do, let's make a paragraph, James 1 verses 2 and 3. Where James says, consider it pure joy, my brethren, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance, and perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. As you look at that, take a piece of paper and jot down what you think the subject is and what you think the compliment is. This is 2 and 3. James 1, verses 2 and 3. Oh, really, I'm sorry. 1 through verses 2 to 4. 2 to 4. person next to you what you think the subject is, what you think the compliment is. My brethren, no, not quite, but you're in the broad ballpark, yes.
Our best response to facing various trials.
Our response to facing, what our attitude, our response would be, what's your compliment?
Should be joy.
Okay. You might be more complete than that.
The result of accepting trials joyfully.
All right, what is that?
We will become perfect and complete, lacking nothing.
Okay, good. I think, yes.
Why we should be happy.
What's the compliment?
Because I can experience
good, very good. Yeah, what should why we should have joy in trials, what should be our attitude in trials, why we should have joy in trials, and the compliment is because they lead to maturity. Everything else in between that is designed to support that idea. Now let's try another one. Don't get discouraged. Let's try another one. Yes?
Before we go on, is there only one correct answer?
Sure, because I'm up here and you're down there.
I recall from my colleagues then, who studied your book, I got every one of the test questions wrong.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you haven't changed, have you? Yeah, I think, you know, you may phrase it differently. You may have, you know, what is your attitude? What should our attitude be in trials? And the answer can be joy, or joy because they lead to maturity. But why we should have joy in trials because they lead to maturity. But basically, I think that the statement may be different, but it basically gets at what he's talking about, what he's saying about it. Take the next one. Look at verse... look at verse 5 through verse 8. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. That man shouldn't think he will receive anything of the Lord. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. All right, what do you think the subject is? Jot that down. What do you think the compliment is?
Some of your subjects seem to be statements, and you call them statements, and yet some of your subjects seem to be questions.
There you are. If I'm doing that, the subject is always incomplete, and in that sense, it is a question. It can be a statement, though. You could say, if you say, what's he talking about? He's talking about our attitude in trials. If you analyze that, you're really talking about what should be our attitude in trials. If you say, what's he talking about? He's talking about the test of a person's character. But he's really talking about what is the test of a person's character. So it's the fact that you don't state that what or who or why or when, it is, I think, always implied. Wisdom of God. But he's not telling you everything about the wisdom of God. All right, how to get wisdom. What's the compliment? Yeah, ask God for it in faith. Okay. Now, to be strict about this, he is not just talking about how to get wisdom. In the context, what is he talking about? Yeah, how to get wisdom in trial. And the way to get wisdom in trials is to ask God for it in faith. That is, in that sense, the context governs it. When I went to a Christian college, and I remember at final exams one day, they asked a student to pray. And he prayed, "Oh God, help those of us who studied to remember what we studied, and those of us who didn't study to remember what we learned in high school." He may have used this. Well, I guess it was a trial. It's how to get wisdom in trials. Let me take just a couple more. Look at Luke chapter 1. This is a different kind of paragraph. Luke chapter 1, and look at the first four verses. What was that like there? Not quite. What is the benefit of what? Of Luke's eyewitness account. Yeah, the subject is why Luke wrote Luke. And the compliment is that Theophilus might know of a certainty the things that he had been taught. Everything else in between that is elaborating that idea. But why did Luke write his gospel? So that Theophilus would know of a certainty the things he had been taught. Subject and the compliment.
So with that, there's no, you've really sort of just given verses second half of 3 and 4. So the whole, when you're writing the compliment, you don't need to include, I mean, I was listening to, do I need to include something about the other stuff that's been written? You're saying you don't need to include.
No, you're asking, you know, what's he talking about and what's he saying about it? And then everything in between is a support of that idea.
So if you're dealing with the whole passage, your big idea might just be one verse. It might all, the actual big idea thing might be just
yep. straight out of the passage. That quite often, in this case, you have a subject that's not stated. That is, Luke doesn't say, this is why I wrote, but it's psychologically implied. Let me take just one more to pick up what you're saying. Look at Psalm 1. It's a little tougher.
Those two, what is he saying and what is he talking about? Is that the order of it?
Yes. The subject is what is this person talking about? The complement is what is he saying about what he's talking about? You see? So the subject is the answer to the complete, definite answer to the question, what's this person talking about? You can't get a complement until you get the subject. And a group of statements without a subject is just a brush pile, kind of a harangue. So you have to get the subject, and then you ask, if that's the subject, how does everything here relate? What's he talking about? You try Psalm 1.
What is he talking about? And then what is he saying about what he's talking about?
Yeah, that's right. What is he saying about what he's talking about? That's the compliment. Can you take a stab at it? All right, the subject is the contrast between wicked and the righteous. Right. Is it you're right. You're up to the plate. It's a bit more precise than that. It's not just a total contrast between the wicked and the righteous. All right, but he's talking about blessing, but he's talking about it in a particular way. Now, I think we stay on this one. We've got it just a bit more sure. The subject is what? That's an idea. That if you state that, it's a direct statement. Okay.
Why then, godly won't stand in judgment?
What? All right, but he's got a whole, you're getting close, but there's the whole thing, you've left out a whole lot about the godly.
The blessing of the righteous and the end of the ungodly.
Okay, you're right. What is the blessing of the righteous? Yeah, that is, in here I think it's, what is the final result of the righteous and the unrighteous? And what does he say? What is the final result? Yeah, the righteous man will stand, the wicked man will perish. He actually gives you the idea in the final verse, where when he says the Lord watches over the way of the righteous and the way of the wicked will perish, to watch over the way is a poetic way of saying he will see to it that it's established. And at the end of the first stanza, the point is that he is like a well-watered tree. And the emphasis there, when he says he's planted by the streams of water yields its fruit in season, whose leaf doesn't wither, whatever he does prospers. The emphasis there is that this tree stands and is fruitful, whereas the other, like the chaff, is blown away. So basically, the contrast is the contrast, as you said, between the righteous and the wicked. I think the focus is probably the end of the righteous and wicked. And the righteous will stand, and the wicked will be blown away. Yes. That is the answer to the first stanza. Well, I don't think it takes into account the emphasis on the wicked. That second, I think what you have there is would be a good subject and complement for the first stanza. But there's a whole section about the wicked, which I think you would bring into your subject. All right, as I see it, what is the final result of the righteous and the wicked? And the righteous shall stand, and the wicked will perish. Now, I would not object to somebody saying he is contrasting the righteous and the wicked, and he is saying that the righteous will stand and the wicked will perish. You know, but the emphasis here in the psalm tends to fall on the final result, certainly of the wicked. Whereas, and so when he says the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, I take it that is a way. The picture of the tree has about it stability and so forth, as opposed to chaff, which is grown away.
The amount of material that we use as a paragraph is going to change that. Now, is it with poetry, do we need to take in the whole piece?
Well, in this case, if we had had more time, I might have given you the first three verses to ask you what the subject and complement was there, and then to ask you what the subject and complement is of the second stanza, and then what is the subject and complement of both stanzas together. Because the subject and complement of the first is the subject would be what is the result of living a righteous life, and the complement is it's like a well-watered tree. The second, what is the result of being an unrighteous person? It's like chaff on the summer threshing floor. It is temporary. He brings it together in the final sentence. That sentence is really the idea of the psalm.
But when you do that, the first part, which is an orientation thing, seems that's one of those things of weighing up. You go with the end, saying through the conclusion of that. But the first part seems to be orientation. In other words, who's the man to be envied? He's the person whose focus is on the law of the Lord, the Word of God. That person in the end will stand. How do you include the orientation, which is more a present focus?
Oh, I think, I think the question you would have if you had, what is the end of the righteous and the wicked? The righteous will stand, the wicked will perish. Then as you were dealing with a question you would ask about righteousness is what is the mark of the righteous person who stands? And the compliment is, he is at home in the counsel of God.
And is it laziness or avoiding the point to have a compliment with an and in it? So that you've actually got...
I don't think it's a moral failure, but tell me what you got there.
I got the subject wrong, apparently. But I have the way to experience God's blessing. I'm not just an argument.
Sure.
But then I have, is to avoid wickedness and to ground your life in God's...
No, you can do that. It's possible to have a double complement.
Okay.
You can only have a single subject, but you can have two complements, two major statements made to the subject. In fact, sometimes you can have three. In a longer passage, you can have three. You can have a bunch, really, but...
I just thought that if I was allowed to do that, I would have these enormously long compliments.
Yeah, you go on and on and on and on. You know, that comes when people try to include everything in there, and what they really do is give you a paraphrase of the passage. Very good. Yeah, what you're really doing after you, the process through which I tend to go is to read a paragraph and say, what's the subject and complement? But then that's synthesis. But then I do analysis to see whether or not I can make everything, you know, fit that, and then I go back. I usually start with, what's the subject? Does the subject fit all of this? And then I go back and put the complement together.